just like to say, as we begin the sixth of the initial six planned sessions, so just want to say, half of myself, not about everyone else, but I thought that I'd go for one session and then maybe sort of pop in for the rest of them, maybe, you know, see if I can avoid, you know, I know I'm running the thing, but, you know, I don't know if I've got time necessarily to come every week, but it's been a case of sort of whatever else I might have on a Tuesday night has been shoved out the window, because it just I think electrifying is a good way of describing your Philip Joshua. So I just want to say on behalf of everyone, thank you so much. It's been enlightening, electrifying, and truly enjoyable. We did say in initial six sessions, personally, I'd very much like it to carry on. I think other people feel the same way. I think what we'll do, perhaps, is I'm going to be speaking with Roman Mitch tomorrow. We can plan what to do. If people have got suggestions as how they'd like it, if they'd like it a little bit changed or if they'd like it a little bit tweaked, please speak to me. Let me know if you think that if we did it in a certain way, it would be more attractive to other people. Then let us know and we can work it through. But again, thank you so much. Thank you all for coming and being such a good audience, I think, and a challenging audience.
Thank you.
But you still don't get a yacht.
I haven't got my yacht yet, no. Good evening, everybody. Thank you for a wonderful and lovely introduction from everybody. I have to say that I did say right in the very beginning, in the first session, that this is a very, very tough topic, extremely tough material. And, you know, it's Jewish philosophy, and this is very, very hard, intense concepts. And I've been asked, you know, to give it over as clearly as possible. And it isn't easy, but I've been giving it a go. But good for you for actually sticking with it all. It's like really not easy for this material. It's really hard. But we've done the worst of it, as it were. The hardest is done. It's really the first two sections, the first two chapters, which we've done. Everything else does get easier from here on in. Just to let you know, there'll be some more challenging concepts, but they're not very abstract concepts. They're concepts you have to grapple with. But it isn't as if, like, let's actually think of something we've never thought about before. That's done and dusted. So well done to you for being here. Thank you so much for asking such brilliant questions. It's really, really fun to give it to people that are involved. What I'd like to do, I have an unimaginable ambition. And it's not this super yacht that I've been talking about. Well, actually, maybe it is. That is really an unimaginable ambition. The unimaginable ambition is to finish chapter 3, which is Man, which actually finishes on page 59. And we're at the bottom of page 49. And getting through it all is absolutely huge. So what I wanted to do was just go over a couple of concepts. I think one of the ways that this thing has been working is that if I give you an analogy to grapple with first, and then you get over the analogy, then when we read it in the text, it's really not that hard. And then we can just kind of fly through it. So there's two analogies. There's two, well, one is an analogy, one is a Maamar Chazal, that I want to give you. Okay. Okay, there is a Tosefta. A Tosefta is the commentary to the Mishnah written by Rabbi Chiya, who was the top Talmud, the top student of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi was the rector of the Mishnah, which means he took all the Mishnaic material together and built what we have today as the six orders of the Mishnah. And his top Talmud was Rabbi Chiya. Rabbi Chiya wrote a commentary to it, and that commentary is considered the most authoritative commentary that there is to the Mishnah, because it is the number one student of the man that kind of bolted the Tanaic material together. The stuff which he didn't compile into a Mishnah is called a Brisa. A Brisa. Brisa literally means externals. So the Brisa is the Tanaic material which Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi decided that he's not going to put into the compilation of the Mishnah. There's a Tosefta that says as follows. It's in Sota, which is the Masechta that deals with the woman that pops. The Sota woman, that's the woman that has the exploding lady. It's a very, very unusual thing. But there's a whole Masechta about it. The exploding lady, I can't go into it now, but ask me about the exploding lady. It sounds interesting, so you can ask me about it afterwards. By the way, what is this whole exploding lady business? No, it's actually, and it could be exploding men as well. Yeah, we could be exploding gentlemen as well. There will be exploding gentlemen, whatever they are. Look, I can talk about that later. But anyway, there's a Tosefta that says as follows. When God was thinking about making creation, obviously, he doesn't have to think about it in the way that we do. He decided to ask the Melochim, the angels, what they thought of it. Now, he didn't need to do that, obviously. He wanted to do that to teach us something, that before you go on a big venture, you should take advice. That's why he did it. So he got a group of angels to get together and said, listen, I have this wonderful idea. I'm going to make entire creation, which we've discussed in the past two chapters. And then the peak of that creation is going to be a creature which stands absolutely perfectly balanced between good and bad. I'll create good and I'll create bad. Plot this creature bang in the middle. I'll give it a maximal test. And then if it wins over the test, what I'll do is I'm going to give it points of closeness to me. And that'll be me giving of my good to another. And that should all be in the bag from the chapters that we've already done. So Melachim quizzed and said, well, what exactly is going on with this creature? He said, well, the creature will be half animal, half monkey, half mammalian, and half angel. I'll take an angelic type creature called a soul. I'm going to stuff that straight into what is basically essentially an ape. And it'll roam around this physical world and it'll tussle with the spiritual versus the physical and it'll come out with that. So Melachim said, okay, we'll debate that. So they went away, had a huddle, and a vocal huddle, let's talk about that. And they came back to God, and they said, yeah, we've got a conclusion. And God said, okay, what do you think? And that group of Melachim, it's called a cut, any group of Adim, of witnesses, or any group is called a cut. So that cut of Adim, that cut of Melachim came up and said, we've really thought about this, thank you so much for bringing us into this, and we think it's absolutely, completely wrong. It's just not going to work. And we've really thought about it, and it's just bound for failure. It's going to be doomed, and you shouldn't do it. Okay? And then proceeded to kill all those Melachim. Killed them all. Got a second cut of Melachim. Another group. Did exactly the same thing. Explained it in the exact same way that I've just told you about it. They went off, huddled together, thought about it, came back and said, you know, we've really thought about this. We know what you did to the first group, and we agree with the first group. We think this is absolutely doomed to failure. It's not going to work. It's just not a good idea. Okay? Killed all those Melachim. Just killed them all. Got a third group. Third group, giving the exact same brief. I'm thinking of doing this. What do you think? It's to Seth and Saita. Okay, I'm bringing you to Seth and Saita. What do you think? They got together, they huddled together like this. Extremely, obviously, Melachim, extremely honest, right? They're not bribed. They come up to God after their huddle meeting. They said like this. To be completely honest with you, we agree with groups one and two. But, little bit of a but here, we saw what you did to groups one and two. Now, you want to kill us, you can kill us. This is our conclusion. But because we saw that you were displeased with the previous two groups, we have assumed that really you want to go ahead with this anyway, whatever we say. Now, if you want to go ahead with this anyway, whatever we say, and you ain't coming along and saying this is absolutely not going to work, we have to conclude that we don't understand how this would work. These are the Melachim, these are the angels speaking to God. We don't get it. I wouldn't do it. I think it's a flawed design. But you know what? You're telling us that every time someone tells you it's a flawed design, you're killing them. Which means you're very unhappy with that. Why would you be unhappy with that unless you feel as if you're going to do it anyway, right? So look, our conclusion is we wouldn't do it. But we saw that you're so displeased, so we must assume that you have a way that is simply beyond us. And you've decided to do this, notwithstanding the fact that we can't understand it. But we still think it's not a good idea. He let those angels live. What do we take from this? We can take something in our everyday lives from this. If you think there's something you can't achieve, maybe God's got a way of getting you to achieve it, and you couldn't understand how that is. I want to be able to achieve something which I think is impossible. Let's say I want to be able to achieve complete mastery over the Derech Hashem. Through Jewish philosophy, see, it's at my control. Ha, it's impossible. Maybe God's got a way. Maybe. It can happen. Maybe you can achieve more than you think. But what are we doing talking about this now? The answer's like this. The soul, which we're going to talk about now, which was infused inside the body, is in a constant state of strife with the body. And we discussed last time that our free will is the product of internal strife, while God's free will is merely the ability to do something without anyone stopping him from doing it. That's no, there's no strife in him. He's not like, should I do it? Shouldn't I do it? Should I? What's he going to choose? The wrong way? That can't be. We can choose the wrong way. You may have heard the idea that on Yom Kippur, the Yetzirah, the Satan, has a holiday. You ever heard that idea that the Yetzirah does not prosecute on Yom Kippur? That's from the word Hasatan, meaning the Satan, literally, which means the impediment in Hebrew. Has the gematria, has the numerical value of 364. Which means that angelic creature is off for the day. He's not going to prosecute. He's basically a divine prosecutor. He's a litigation. He's divine litigation. We'll talk about why we need that later. Now, between you, me, and everyone listening on the tape, have you ever been in synagogue on Yom Kippur and maybe wanting a sandwich, a foot massage, maybe a milkshake, maybe a nice stroll, maybe a cigarette? Ever been wanting that?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, I think all of us, right? I think we could all say 100% that we maybe didn't want to, you know, we could have done with a break. So the Yetzirah, what does it mean the Yetzirah is not working, that evil inclination is not working? Let me explain something to you which is very vital to understand the next chapters. There's two Yetzirahs. There's two evil inclinations. One, and the most important one for us, is simply our physical body. Because this body that we've got here, which is a mammalian body, is always driving after bodily pleasures. It could always do with a foot massage. It could always do with a milkshake. It could always do with these things. It always wants repose. It always wants to sit by the beach. It always wants a super yacht in San Marino. It's just something it wants. It's driven towards that because that's what it is. At the end of the day, it's an animated clod of earth. That's what it is. All animals are animated clods of earth, as we'll learn. Human beings have something different. On top of that animalistic part of us, we've been given a complex, in suspension as it were, of a divine, lofty creature called a neshama, which is a human soul. And that human soul associates with this physical body. Now, in Yom Kippur, the body doesn't turn off. The spiritual concept of the Yetzirah, the spiritual concept of the Yetzirah, turns off. Why would you need that? Let's say an individual has worked on himself so hard that he simply has overcome his physical Yetzirah. He doesn't need foot massages. He doesn't need cocktails by the beach. Just doesn't need it. He's worked on himself so hard, he would now lose free will. God has put something in creation to rebalance the order of things, and that's an angelic form of the Yetzirah. So an individual can sometimes be tempted to do negative things, so he can overcome that, or she can overcome that, still have free will, still earn brownie points, because that's what it's all about. This is the casino. Remember the casino from last time's analogy of the guy Kevin? Remember Kevin went in and the smarmy guy and the boss? Sorry, Richard in the middle, you're just going to miss out on that one. But there was an analogy of Kevin going into the casino. We have to keep the chips in play, even if an individual's got to a high level. So if an individual's got to a high level over his physicality, there has to be something that comes along and keeps Bechira, free will, in play, so that we can still keep the system running. Now, in the Garden of Eden, which we talked about last time as well, we had this one man having one choice, once, on one day, justifying the whole lot. Had he have overcome his physical urges, which was basically, I think Andy asked the question, what actually was that? The answer was his own ego, of wanting to do something himself. Had he have done that, he'd have been absolutely end game, everything's good, ready to go. He was immortal, created immortal, everything's good to go. Now that he failed, he's got to die. Because we said he's going to die, that the Torah actually said, the day you eat of it, you'll surely die. Are you going to become mortal if you eat of this? Don't do it. It's poisonous. It'll bring something called death onto you. You don't want to do that. We've got a problem. Now that he's going to die, what are we going to do with these two components of the human being, which aren't destined to actually die originally? Plan A was humanity should be immortal. Plan B is now they're going to have to go through a lifetime, which is earning reward. Then they're going to have to die and then get the reward. What it was meant to be is go through a lifetime where you earn reward, this world, the Garden of Eden, win it over, and then get in to get your reward of closest to God justifiably. That didn't work out, so now we have to have a middle stage, and that's called death. Death is the separation of the neshama, of the spiritual component, from the physical component. Is everyone clear about that so far? Where does the soul go? Because it can't stay here. God had to create an entire new zone, specifically as a repository for human souls, when they leave the physical body, now that Adam did what he did. And that area is called Olam HaNeshamos, or in Sephardi, Olam HaNeshamot, the world of souls. And it is literally a holding zone where souls wait in order to be rejoined with a physical body. Why must a soul be rejoined with a physical body? God's gift, God's goodness, God's wanting to give his good to another has to be perfect, right? Let's say you go into a Marks and Spencer's. There's a beautiful bacon sandwich on granary. You really want it. No one's looking. And you decide, I don't want to have it. You don't put it in your basket. You don't check out with it. When the time comes for reward, what must that reward consist of? It must consist of a spiritual component, the desire to overcome one's physical bodily urges. And it's got to come with a physical component. Your body decided to subjugate itself to your soul. So the full reward, when you do a mitzvah, you light a menorah, let's say, on Hanukkah. I've got news for you. Your soul may say, let's do a mitzvah. But who's cashing the checks? Your body. For a man, you want a late fill-in? That's all very nice. You're going to need an arm and a head. Okay? I mean, someone's actually physically got to do something. So if you weren't to reward the body, the closeness to the Creator would not be complete, which means that this ultimate reward that we're talking about has to exist in the physical world. So this world of souls is not the end point. It's just a holding zone, because you've got to put the soul back with the body, otherwise the reward is incomplete. So part of this reward must be physical, because the physical body was also involved in this. Does that all make sense? No, not really. Dovi Coleman has a question.
The body is nothing. I mean, what is the body? It's as you said before, it's an animated clod of earth. Why does it need rewards? It's not something which is eternal. It's not something which is relevant, really.
Excellent, beautiful, brilliant question. Did everyone hear the question? The body is basically irrelevant. It's just a vehicle for the soul. Really, it's all about the soul. So just give a spiritual reward. Is that your question?
Yeah.
Okay, it's like this. It's a beautiful question. The job of the neshama, and we're going to read this black and white inside, the whole purpose of the neshama, the reason the neshama exists, the reason it was created, is only to purify a physical body. That's the only reason it exists. The reason the physical body was created is only to be purified by a soul. We're going to read this black and white. That's the only reason a body's there. A body is there as a vehicle, like a spaceman. Look, if you go... Today we live in an unbelievable time. There's people flying about in the ISS right now. They're in space. Like, they're doing that or that. I'm just, for the tape, I'm mimicking anti-gravity, low gravity. I'm sorry. It's not a very good one either, but it's kind of like running around like that. So there's no gravity here. It's amazing. Now, if they want to step outside, they can't. Because they simply can't operate in that environment. They can't. They physically can't do it. They need an atmosphere. And there is no atmosphere. So what do they have to do? Get in a spacesuit. I want to tell you something. When you're outside, it takes sometimes up to 4 hours to get into a spacesuit. 4 hours. A complicated spacesuit. It's not, you don't just get into... You're not going to get that on the tape either. But basically, you just jump into a space, you just run out. Oh, I'm a bit late. I've got to go on a spacewalk. Sorry. Woo! You have to get literally... They're millions and millions of dollars, these spacesuits. Let me ask you a question. When you're out in space, you're doing like a 6-hour spacesuit, and it takes you hours to get in and hours to get out. How do you go to the toilet? Has anyone asked that question? They just, you know, there's a giant porta cabin just floating in space. They just have to kind of like get to it. Yeah. And it's like, you know, they get it. It's like an engaged vacant. No way. The suit itself is designed to absorb the waste of the astronaut. There's a special polymeric gel, which is all around the legs of the astronaut. He can go to the toilet and it just gets absorbed. It's amazing design. And without it, he can't walk, function, live in that area. He can't fix the telescopes or whatever it is he's doing. Our body's a spacesuit. Our body is the spacesuit which allows our soul to exist, function, and perform its mission in this atmosphere of the physical world. Without it, it's milk without a bottle. Can't do anything. So the body becomes relevant when it becomes enhanced and purified by the soul's intentions. You see, it's like this. Let's take someone like the Vilma Gaon or something like that. Someone where there's unarguable greatness there. When he put on his tefillin, is the arms of the Vilna Gaon, is the hand of Rashi that wrote the commentary to the Torah, the ultimate commentary to the Torah. So Moses gave the Torah on Mount Sinai. Rashi explained it to everyone. You understood it before Rashi came along, right? Through his hand, is that not now elevated? Is that now truly irrelevant? No. The answer is because how he used it. Humanity is unusual, unlike an animal, in the fact that man elevates or relegates everything he touches. We either justify or nullify everything we're involved in our lives. The Alps are waiting for us to use them well. If not, why make them? Remember, we said in section one that everything that was created, everything was only in the service of this one creature. The Alps, fish, squid, lemonade, peanut butter, vultures, are all somehow working in the world environment to keep us in an environment where we can make a choice. And part and parcel of that matrix is the human body. So the human body has to be involved. Why it becomes relevant is because God, who is totally eternal, now communes with the lowest of the low, animated clods of earth. That means he can manifest his good to the very furthest reaches of dimensions. The most physical stuff. This stuff. Coarse. Physicality. The ultimate Kiddush Hashem, the ultimate sanctification of God's name, is when he can be involved in that at the lowest level. This is part of the reason that the angels, when they asked for the Torah from God, not to give it to man, but to keep it to them, Moses answered, but do you have parents you have to honour? Do you have food that you have to avoid? Do you have idols there? We can do things in a much more low... We can do things on the lowest possible level. That's great if we use it right. So the body, even though intrinsically, yes, it's an animated clod of earth, when it's used by a soul to be purified and do these acts, it becomes intrinsically worthy. It's a tremendous aliyah. Let's see that inside, okay? Is everyone up to speed on what I've... Sid, you got a question?
A very quickie question.
A quickie question. Let's do a quickie question.
I may have misunderstood you. Did you say or infer that after death, the soul goes off to its holding zone and is then dispatched to another body?
No, I didn't say that.
That sounded a bit we'll like talk Hinduism.
No. Hindu...
cycle of reincarnation.
There is a reincarnation tradition in Judaism, and we'll talk about that, why that must exist. But it is not vital. It has to be a loophole which must exist in certain cases, which we'll discuss. And we'll talk about why that must be. What must be is a soul must be taken away from the body. The body must be rebuilt, like purified, through rotting. Then it will be rebuilt, which we'll talk about today. The soul must be recharged like a battery in a charger unit. Then the soul and that body are reunited, if they are so worthy, in order to receive what they were meant to receive had Adam just not have sinned. We'll talk about that now, okay?
Yeah.
There is a cycle of reincarnation, and look, before bedtime, there's something to say, okay? There are those that say sometimes, on your handy-dandy Art Scroll Siddur on page 288, there is something called the Bedtime Shema. Called the Bedtime Shema. Yeah. It's a Shema we say at bedtime. And we say this, Master of the Universe, I hereby forgive anyone who angered or antagonized me or who sinned against me. You've got to say this every single night of your life. whether against my body, my property, my honour, or against anything of mine, whether he did so accidentally, willfully, carelessly, purposely, whether through speech, deed, thought, or notion, whether in this transmigration or another transmigration, if I've lived in this world before. Art Scroll has a star and says, see below. I think we need to actually just talk about that just very quickly. Where's where is it? He says here, this term Gilgul, literally to cycle, or Galgal means wheel in Hebrew, refers to the doctrine of Gilgul Neshamos, transmigration of souls, one of the most mystical doctrines in Kabbalistic literature. In very simple terms, it refers to the reincarnation of certain souls for a second period of physical life on earth. One of the reasons we forgive anyone at bedtime is if someone is punished on our account, we're punishable for that. Because God now has to punish someone, he hates doing it. So if you forgive them, he can forgive them. If you give them, he doesn't have to punish you. So before bed, Chazal said, our sages said, you know what, forgive everyone. It's good for you. It's just good for you long term. Okay?
Can I just clarify?
Yeah. I've lost my page.
This, as you're saying now.
Yeah.
So the soul goes into this.
It's 49.
As Sid says, holding it.
Yeah.
And the body goes to be purified. The purification of the body.
It is done via rotting. That's right. It's not complete destruction.
There's no body again. But the soul.
It's not completely destroyed. The bodies don't completely go.
Well, they say there's a little bone.
The
Lutz.
It's the Lutz bone. Very, very good. Which isn't destroyed. And that Lutz bone will be the genetic starting point for rebuilding the body through a molecular genetic reconstruction.
Okay, I can understand that. I can accept that.
Mm.
But I just want to get to the clarification of the purification. What we're talking about with this purification, because the way I've grasped it, according to what you were saying, is that the neshama is like a memory chip. Everything you've done, good, bad or indifferent, is registered on it.
Beautiful.
And it goes up into this holding zone.
Love it.
And it gets cleansed or memory rectified. All the bad taken out, maybe the good is enhanced, I don't know.
We'll talk about
that. The body, why would anything happen to the body? The body's going to be destroyed anyway in the natural course.
It wasn't meant to be.
No, but once this situation has been set in motion,
it's going to die.
Then it's going to decay anyway. That's the natural order of things.
There is no one so righteous who has never sinned before you. We say that on Yom Kippur. It's one of our defense mechanisms. If God gets angry at us, what do you want from us? We're humans. When the people of Israel were walking out of Egypt and they had sinned with a golden calf, one of Moses' answers to God was, what do you want from them? For 200 years they were worshipping idols in Egypt. What do you want? What do you want? That's what people do. We make mistakes. When you make mistakes, you sully the body. The body is actually damaged by what we call sin. Because sin, as we'll learn, this negativity, this distance from God's will, actually corrupts man's body. And everyone has a bit of corruption. And that corruption must be removed. Because to put a recharged soul back in a corrupted body would limit God's ability to give good to it. And therefore kibosh the whole problem of God wanting to give good to another. Has to be perfect. Has to be a completely clean slate. Now, it wasn't meant to be the way it is now. But now that we've entered a world of corruption, we've got to be purified. Now, you can ask, what happens for the greatest, most righteous person that ever lived? Why does he have to die? Answer is, when Adam ate of it, he actually incorporated a level of corruption into all humanity, notwithstanding any sins that any person might do ever again. That's it. He's ruined the system. He has corrupted and adulterated the system beyond being able to continue as it is.
Good deeds that say Moshe Rabbeinu or Rabbi Akiva.
Not good enough to prevent from death.
It's not enough to overcome.
No. Although that's what we're working towards. It's not enough to overcome the situation until the end point of that. We understand, we have a tradition from our sages, which we'll learn about. There's only 6,000 years to Jewish history. We're 577.
That's the doctrine of original sin.
Sorry?
That's the doctrine of original sin.
We'll talk about that. What we're doing about it, we're fixing up the problem that was incorporated into man's being in the Garden of Eden. The root cause of that problem was an ego malfunction. It was an ego malfunction, as we discussed last time. Basically, it was Adam over asserting his ego over God, saying, my reasons for eating this are more important than God's reasons for me not eating it, which we're working at. So let's actually see this all inside. We've gone through a lot of it. Let's actually just kind of run through it as much as we can. If you have a pencil, you may need, I'd like you, if you can, to make a mark. There's a few things I'd like to say. But at the bottom of page 49, point 7. We're normally aware of the soul's existence only because it provides us with life and the ability to think. It is necessary to realise, however, the soul has another function. If you could highlight, underline, whatever you can do here. Here we go, Dovey. To purify man's physical body. That's it. That's its function. Gradually elevating it, the physical body, until it too, the physical body, can also take pleasure from perfection along with the soul. There must be a physical body in the next world. This world doesn't exist yet. It's this world recreated. We'll talk about that. In this place where God's going to give a physical to another, it has to be partly, it has to be physical. Has to be. Now, if Adam had not sinned, turn over, top of page 51, he would have been able to attain this total perfection immediately, just avoiding the one test. His soul would, or passing it rather, his soul would have purified his body step by step, which is something it is designed to do, until he reached the level required to permanently partake of the everlasting bliss. You should know there is a tradition of our sages that there are 248 organs and 365 sinews in our body. And each one is attached to one of the 248 positive mitzvahs and the 365 negative mitzvahs, making the 613. So if all those are fixed by doing the mitzvahs, you've perfected everything. But there's a problem. When Adam sinned, things were greatly changed. The amount of evil that existed initially was just enough to ensure that man would be in a perfect balance, allowing him to gain perfection through his own efforts. What was that evil? If you remember back to last time, yes, last week's session, or if you weren't in last week's session, for Richard in the middle, people like that, what was the evil, and Sid, what was the evil that existed in Gan Eden? No, that tree of knowledge wasn't evil.
The
serpent's statements were evil versus God's directive. God said, don't do it, and left the scene. The serpent said, you know why, scared of you. That was the evil. So that was all that was needed. That was the evil that existed in the world at the time. Nowhere else was evil found. In the notice, the good and the evil in the Garden of Eden was all words. It was speech.
But in God's perfection, he must have known that was going to happen.
He didn't know that it was going to happen. It's happening now.
No, I mean that man would fail.
But it's happening all at the same time. So it's not that God could know anything that's going to happen. It's all happening now. Mm. It's not as if he'll be aware that it will happen. It's happening now. Because God lives outside of time. Mm. Therefore, it's not something that he knew that was going to happen. Really, he no, it was something that was happening instantaneously. It's happening right now. Mm-hmm. Adam is also being created right now. We're being born right now.
But the Torah existed first.
That's outside the realm of time. So how can you say the word first if there's no time? Isn't that great? Yeah. He made time. So if you make time, you're not in it, right? We talked about making chocolate eggs, right? And making cars. The fact that I can make a chocolate egg does not mean I am inside a chocolate egg.
Well, that's a very difficult concept.
Yeah.
I agree with you, it's incredibly difficult, but it has to be true, because that means if he's bound by time, he's imperfect. Because he doesn't know what's going to happen tomorrow either. He's waiting for you to do it. That can't be! It doesn't work like that. The whole question, if God really knows if I'm going to jump the red light tomorrow, do I really have free will, is not a question. It's no question. God is aware of you making the decision to jump the red light now, because you're at the red light now. Because there is no tomorrow, there is no yesterday for him. Because he's not bound by time. So how can you talk about before and after if there's no time? We're bound by time. We live through the fourth dimension of time. We don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. That's our own human frailty. He doesn't have that problem. That knocks that philosophical question on the head. Mm. Okay, let's just in case anyone asks you, if you're so clever, how do you, hey, if I really know that, look, the question, just say, the question isn't even a question, because you can't put human frailties upon an infinite creator. Okay. It was worth it just for that, right? It was worth turning up just for that, so you can have that. When Mansindo, he caused evil. Now, this is terrible news for us. He caused evil to increase. It wasn't just words of the serpent. Both in himself and all of creation, everything got ruined. Now, I think Dobby asked me at the end of a question. Why is it that the whole world had to get ruined? The answer's like this. You've got this perfect being, Adam and Rishon, an unbelievable, incredible person. He sins. Now he sins. His whole framework of mind has changed. You have to change the world as well. Because otherwise there's no arena for free will, which is perfectly balanced. If you kept Adam inside the garden, now that he's on a much lower level, he sinned, he ate it. That's how it was. And I don't know what it is. No, it was my wife. Yeah. Which we talked about. Now you can't be walking around with talking serpents. That's too much for you. What the first thing he did? He said, get out of Garden Eden. You can't stay here anymore. This arena is not right for your free will level now. You have to now exist in a lower existence. More animalistic, more basal, more ruined, so that your free will choices will be even. Otherwise it's not fair for you. Of course that's to make sense. As a result, it became much more difficult for him to attain perfection that God intended for him. He's made our work much, much harder, as I'll explain. At first, it was very easy for man to overcome his natural fault and attain perfection. All he had to do was not eat of the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and bad. That was it. That was how to attain perfection. The highest wisdom, who is God, had arranged things in the best and fairest manner, not loading the dice. The only reason why evil and deficiency had to exist, I would add in man, was to make it part of his nature, a part that he would willfully abandon in favour of good and thereby justify the entire system. By simply disassociating himself from deficiencies in both himself and the world, which was his desire for his own ego and to eat of this fruit, the first man was supposed to bring about the perfection immediately. No further effort would be required. Nothing, you're just done. Doesn't that make sense from God's point of view? If you're making it from the boardroom level, that would make perfect sense. That's how you'd want to make the system. When Adam sinned, however, he personally caused concealment of perfection and thus an increase of evil. Man himself was responsible for the greater amount of evil that existed in him because he did it. He imbued it. Notice we talked that the first sin was substance abuse. Substance abuse was the first actual sin. And it therefore became much more difficult for him to abandon it because now he's an addict. Once you start taking a drug, it's much harder to stop. He could no longer earn perfection as easily as when he personally bore no responsibility for his personal deficiencies. When he was made Adam, he had a deficiency. His deficiency was he could, if he was so desirous of, eat of this fruit. That's a deficiency he's got. He could muck up. That was all of his deficiency. But he's not responsible for that. That's how he's built. Once he starts taking the forbidden material, now he's actually personally responsible for the damage this drug does to him. That's a personal responsibility. Do you see the difference? This is amazing. I've highlighted or underlined this next sentence. The effort to required now, post-sin, to earn perfection was therefore doubled. Doubled! What's the doubling? That's a very important line. When I give tests on Derech Hashem, this is one of the... I give five written tests. When I give those tests, and they're very important, really, really important, really good for revision, because they're one-liners. Why was the world created? Just give me one, just with one line. You've got to be able to nail it, boil it all down. When I give tests, this is one of the questions I give. What is the doubling of effort that happened? Man must first bring himself and the world back to the state in which they existed before the first sin. Only then can he raise himself from that state to his destined level of perfection. Let me explain something here. This is my plasticine analogy. I think there's definitely someone in the room who knows his plasticine analogy. Let me give you my plasticine analogy. There's a plasticine analogy. A ball of white plasticine and a ball of black plasticine. Are you with me so far, gentlemen at the back? Rich at the back? You with me? Yeah. Black plasticine. Black plasticine, white plasticine. Black Plasticine is doing a sin, a transgression. Eating of the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and bad. White Plasticine is listening to God and not doing it. It's really that simple. The two balls of plasticine are put in front of you. The directive is, choose the white, stay out of the black. Nothing for this going for turn, but dum-dum-dum-dum. I'm sorry about that. So then listen, choose the white, avoid the black. That's all you have to do. That's it. Now, you're obviously somewhat deficient in the fact that you could choose the black, but that's the way you were built, but that's it. When man said, no, forget this, I'll go for the black, please. You know what happened? The black and white plasticine balls were smushed together. Now, it's a bit like a Venn diagram. There's still a little bit of white and black at the end. Things which are clearly evil and things which are clearly good. Clearly. Like, unarguably good and unarguably evil. But the vast majority of our existence is with grey plasticine. We're not even sure what's good or bad anymore. The first thing we have to do is weed out the grey plasticine into two parts, white and black. Then we have to choose the white and avoid the black. All we have to do is choose the white and avoid the black. It's doubled our work. Which is why, by the way, the halacha, the code of Jewish law, is so expansive going into the minutiae of the details. It's like this. When man took these two words, God said, okay, I'll see you in 6,000 years. By that time, I expect two balls of plasticine back on the table again. And I'd like you to choose the white and avoid the black. Okay. We're just doing this again. Remember with Yonah, when I gave the Yonah shear, afterwards, after he's been in the belly of the fish, and he calls out to God and stuff like that, and he says, okay, I'll do it. God came again to Yonah and said the exact same thing he said in the first chapter. Just get it done. His directive doesn't change because his will doesn't change. It's got to make sense, right? Besides this terrible news for us, justice decreed that neither man nor the world will ever be able to rise to perfection while still in their current fallen state. This comes on to Ronnie's question. Because they remain in this spoiled, non-ideal condition of grey plasticine, and even in the meantime, has increased, both man and the world must go through a stage of, I would say, not destruction, disassembly is a better translation. Disassembly before they can arrive at perfection. Turn over. Now here we go. This is it. Man must therefore die. It's got to be that way. And everything else that was corrupted with him must also perish. Otherwise, it will exist as a barrier to the good that God wants to give eventually. That also could be cross-referenced with the top of page 39. The soul cannot purify the body until the body dies and deteriorates, and a new structure is composed that the soul can enter and purify properly. So that we see here clearly that the soul's job is purification of the body. The entire world must likewise be destroyed and cease to exist in its present form. That doesn't mean obliterated, it means reordered. And it must then be renewed in a state worthy of perfection, just as if Adam had not sinned and entered into a Shabbos, had he not have eaten from the tree of knowledge of good and bad. It was therefore decreed that man should die and then be brought back to life. This is the concept of the resurrection of the dead, known as Techias Hamesim, literally the revivification of the dead. The entire world must similarly be destroyed and then renewed. This is the meaning of what our sages taught. This should be highlighted. It's a very famous Jewish concept. 6,000 years will the world exist, and for 1,000 it will be desolate. That's 6 days of the week and one Shabbos. That Shabbos will be the resting of the earth. At the end of this 1,000 years, that's the Shabbos 1,000 years, that's years from 6,000 to 7,000, then he will renew his world. That, by the way, is sourced in Gomorrah Sanhedrin, page 97a. If you want, you should also see Yechezkel in the 37th chapter. Sorry, the 33rd chapter. 33rd chapter of Ezekiel as well discusses that. Gosh, that was a lot that we just did there. Let's just do a bit of a recap over everything we've done. Very quickly, and then we'll carry on, okay? Adam was existing in a perfectly balanced state. He could have avoided negativity, chosen the good, and entered the world to come, which would be perfected anyway immediately without having to die. He didn't have to do anything. Unfortunately, when he sinned, and it had to be an open, viable option for him to do so, otherwise it wouldn't have been fair for him not to, when he sinned, he corrupted himself and the whole world. Now that he and the world is corrupted, he and the whole world require cleansing of that corruption, because God cannot give of himself to that creature in a rubbished up state. So he and the world require a disassembly and a rebuilding and a rejoining so that God can commune with this creature one way or another. Basically, at the end of the day, God will always win. He has done so. He has loaded the dice one way. He ain't going to fail because he can't fail, right? So if he wants to give his good to another, it's going to happen one way or another. He was just telling Adam, let's do it the best way. I'm winning either way. This game of me giving it, it's going to happen. The best thing for you to do to be a player in this game is do exactly as I tell you. If you don't, you'll make it very hard for yourself and the world, and then I'll get to do exactly what I wanted to do in the beginning.
So Gun Eden is where we want to get back to.
Well, no, Gun Eden is only the portico of Eden. Gun literally means portico. It's Aden. And even Adam didn't get in there. He would have got in there had he just made the right choice. I'm not interested in Gan Eden, I'm interested in Eden proper. Okay. I want to get to what Adam should have done had he not have mucked up.
And that's where nothing would have gone beyond that.
That's it. That's it.
There's no kind of geographical, physical boundary to that. That's just what it
is. Gan Eden is sourced as being south of Syria. He was created at Temple Mount in Jerusalem. Okay. The temple that the God then says he took him from where he was created and placed him in Gan Eden to work it and to guard it. And many sources indicate that it was maybe south of Syria, northern Iraq, that kind of area. Okay. When Adam sinned, however... We did that. When Adam sinned, however... Right. The black plasticine ball, the white plasticine ball smushed together. Now it's our job to weed out the grey so we get the black and the white. Then choose the black and avoid... Sorry. Choose the white and avoid the black. Whoops. That's what I was saying. Choose the black. Choose the white and avoid... Sorry about that. Okay. You know what I mean? But so, then the whole point of this, though, is death and destruction are only a tool in order to act as a purifying stage so that the body and the soul can get done what they need to get done so that they can be rejoined in order to be in the whole position they're meant to be to start with. Unfortunately, Adam mapped that up for us. Point 10, page 53. Goodness, we may even be able to do this. The true time and place of reward, however, will therefore be after the resurrection in this newly renewed world. We call that Olam Haba, the world to come. Now, people often make the mistake and think, someone who was nifted, they're now in Olam Haba. No, they're not. Olam Haba doesn't exist yet. It's this world rebuilt. Where they are is in Olam HaNeshamos. They're in a soul holding zone, which we'll talk about in greater detail and even give out diagrams, hopefully, later. I've got diagrams. If we continue the course, I've got pictures of the postcodes of that place. It's really interesting. Little bit of a forward teaser. There are pictures, you know. Really? Let's carry this thing through. Oh, come on, it's not my first rodeo. Okay. Man will then, in Olam Haba, not here, enjoy his reward with both body and soul. He must, Dovi. He must, because the body was an active component in the choice. The body will be purified by the soul, which is the job of the soul. Why do we have a soul? To purify the body. Why do we have a body? To purify by the soul. And will therefore also be in a proper state to enjoy that good. The body will be great. People will not underline, double underline, and triple underline the word not. I would even say people cannot. I would argue cannot all be equal in this time of reward, because no two people had the same tests. Therefore, no two people really did the same choices, and no two people got that close to Hashem. It's all absolutely phenomenologically unique. It's totally idiosyncratic to the individual. Anubhav has to be your unique relationship that you built with the Creator. However close or far away you are, can I give you this analogy? It takes 2 minutes. Sorry, can I go off? I'm going off. Come with me. It'll be nice. Remember I went off and we told the fox story about the grapes and the orchard? Do you remember that one? I'm going off. Come with me. It'll be fun. And then we'll come back and we'll get back to where we go. I'm going off. All right.
Gone.
There's members of your family that are distant enough that you only ever see them at weddings and funerals. Let's call him Uncle Wolfie. He's Uncle Wolfie. You never see him except at a chasen or a levaya. That is it. And he's that kind of guy you go up to and stuff like that. Let's say this happens. You bump into Uncle Wolfie at a chasen. He comes up to you. How are you? Not lovely to see you. And he say, Uncle Wolfie, how are you? And he turns around and says, you see this? You see this watch? You see the crown here? It's starting to get a bit loose. So I took it to the jewellers and he said it'll take 2 weeks to repair. Uncle Wolfie, but how are you? Oh, it's really getting down. This watch thing is really getting... It's bothering me so much. He's a lovely guy, Uncle. He really is. But what do you think of such a guy? You haven't seen him in, what, 4 years? It's true. It really is true. This thing on this watch is bothering him. The crown on his watch is loose. It's really true. It really is genuinely bothering him. But socially, what's wrong with that discussion? It's petty! Thank you, it's petty! For goodness sake, I don't care about you. Give me big things! I still live in the same house, I still got the same job, you know, Auntie Goldie is fine, but she's getting older. You know, all the same things you're talking about, you know what I'm talking about? Give me big news! We had a grandchild, oh, mazel tov. There's big stuff! You don't have to tell about the buttons on your watch! You're wrong to do it! Who? Now, if you're married, your spouse comes in and you say, how was your day? How was my day? We had a grandchild. I know that. But how was your day? You know what you're talking about with your spouse? Your spouse, the little things. Look, that watch thing. I took it to the jewellers. It took ages. He says it's going to take me 2 weeks. Oh, that jeweller, I wouldn't use that jeweller anyway. I'll go into town. Because there is a different relationship. You understand? It's a relationship. Do you see? Is that, yep. When you go to Uncle Wolfie and he starts telling you about his baby thing, you know why it's wrong? It's wrong because you're frankly not that close to him. Mm-hmm. You can judge how close you are to someone in the world by how petty the things are you discuss with them. That is actually the main marker for closeness to another human being on this earth. I have to make social contextual correctness, obviously. It doesn't mean I come up to you and start discussing my watch. Oh, now I must be very close to you. It doesn't work like that. It must mean that it makes sense for me to discuss these stupid little things with you because that's the relationship I got with you. I must be incredibly close to you. But when you bump into Uncle Wolfie for the first time in 3 years, he starts telling you about these things. Uncle Wolfie, with respect, I just want to hear the headlines. Okay? Big headlines, that's all I'm interested in. Because if you tell me little things, you know, look, you know, I mean... If you see Uncle Wolfie and he starts telling you, oh, I'm very upset about ISIS and it's terrible what's going on. Yeah, but Uncle Wolfie, I don't see it before you. Is there anything else you want to tell me? Your relationship... Okay, I've finished that. I'm coming into the... That was an analogy. Here's the point. Your relationship with the Creator, you can judge by how fickle and petty the things are that you discuss with him. If you only turn up once a year to shul on Yom Kippur, the right thing to say to him is, I don't want to die! Please let me live another year! Please don't kill me! Have mercy on me! And while we're there, Auntie Rosa, she needs a refer shalem. Big things! Big things! If you're very close to Hashem, and I'm talking really close, there's a button here that fell off. Please, could you help me organise it because I can't get the exact replacement. What difference does it make to God about a button or Auntie Rosie? There's no difference. He's infinite. He's organising the electrons in the button on your coat, which means they're blue-orange like everything else. Auntie Rosie's a blue-orange. The buttons on your cuff are a blue-orange. He's infinite. So there's no thing about size or anything like that. The more close you are with the Creator, the closer you've let him into your life. Isn't that an amazing idea? So if when you pray to him, it's not just the massive things, it's the little things, you're more like marrying him. Every morning, Jewish men have to recommit, because men have a commitment problem, women don't. That's some cackling there. A little later again. Yes, that's really very true. Men do have a commitment. So, you know, every morning God said, put a tefillin around your middle finger and utter the betrothal verses. I'll betroth you to me. Three times over. We recommit, we remarry God. And for the entire duration of the morning prayer, we're wearing a wedding band around the middle finger of our left hand. Or the right hand if you're left-handed. A wedding band, because men have got to commit. Men have commitment issues. So you've got to recommit every single day. You don't need to recommit on Shabbos or Yom Tov, because keeping Shabbos or Yom Tov is the commitment. So obviously you don't need the tefillin. Makes sense, right? So if you're marrying the Creator, it makes sense that over a period of time, the things you talk about are more and more petty. This state of closeness to the Creator is actually what he wants. I'm completely coming back to the text. Phew. People will not all be equal in this time of reward, because the level of closeness which I have generated, some people are going to get in, they're going to be like Uncle Alfie. They're going to be like Uncle Alfie. They made it, they're good people, they made it, but they're Uncle Alfies to God. Other people are going to be mummish like a spouse. Uncle, was it Wolfie? Yeah. Uncle, what did I say?
Alfie.
He's another guy also in the weddings of Chasnas. Is that Alfie? Alfie's even further away, I even forgot about him. Uncle Wolfie, sorry.
I was fine with everything else.
You got the analogy wrong, you're right. Uncle, some people are going to be Uncle Wolfie level. They're going to be like, you know, big thing, very rare. And some people are going to be so close to him that they're talking about the closest, most, what you think is most insignificant things I bought because it's an espousal relationship. So not all people are equal, right? They'll attain different levels depending upon their work in their lifetime here on this earth to attain perfection in this world of effort and striving. That's what this world is for. It's a massive examination room full of pitfalls that you were meant to avoid and told how to avoid them by using a manual. This will determine how much the soul can radiate and thus purify and enlighten the body. Why is that necessary? So that both of them, body and soul, can gain this excellence and elevation of closeness to the Creator in Olam Haba and justify the prime protocol of God wanting to give his good to another. This in turn will delimit how worthy they are of bringing themselves close to God, Uncle Wolfie or spousal, basking as it were figuratively in his light, which is his closeness, and enjoying his true good, which is the whole point of the first thing we said in the purpose of creation. This is all kind of, this has got to come together and make sense and lock in with everything that we've learned. Since it's been decreed that man must die, body and soul must remain separated until the time comes for them to be reunited. That's got to make sense. During this period of separation, though, an appropriate place must exist for the two separate parts, the animalistic primate bit and the spiritual angelic-like soul. The body thus returns to its element, the soil, decomposing and losing its form. Since the body originated from dust, it must return to it. And this is what God told Adam in Genesis 3:19, you are dust, and to dust you must return. A worthy soul has only to look forward to the time when what must be done with the resurrected body will have been done to prepare it for this state in Olam Haba that we've just discussed. The body must undergo decay and decomposition, remain in the earth for an appropriate time, and finally be reconstructed anew so the soul can re-enter it. During this intermediate time, however, the soul also needs a place to go. It is for this reason that God prepared something called a soul world. Olam HaNeshamos. It's three lines up in the Hebrew. Middle of the line are three and four words in from the end of the left-hand side of the line. Olam HaNeshamos, the world of souls. When a soul leaves its body, like an astronaut sloughing its spacesuit, it's got to go somewhere it can survive. It enters this soul world and remains there in a state of rest while the body undergoes what it must. And that I put in a line saying that's rotting. During this period, the soul experiences sublime delight. What is this sublime delight? It unfurls. That's the delight of the soul. Because at the moment, it's like a caged tiger. You take an angel and stuff it in a monkey, it's a very unpleasant experience. It can actually like go, oh, that's so much better. Stretch out a bit. Very much like that which will be bestowed on the individual later in the period of genuine reward, and I've written in there, Olam Haba, the world to come. Its level in the soul world, the soul's level in the soul world, is also determined by its accomplishments in this world, just as is the ultimate reward. By the way, there is a sense of time in the soul world, so much so that God created seasons, which only happen in the soul world. And the seasons give the soul a sense of time, so it doesn't lose its identity with the concept of time, so it'll be ready to re-enter the body in this world, which will be bound by time. Special seasons in the world of souls that are only experienced by souls. So we assume there's flora and fauna in the soul world, yes.
Sorry, just going back to clause 10 or section 10.
Clause 10, yeah.
Yeah. We're talking about inequality.
Okay. Yes.
So what happens to the person who hasn't got mental capacity or a strong mind?
Excellent question. A brilliant question.
So what, does it all depend on the effort or does it depend
it's
on the comprehension?
All down to the effort. Each individual is means tested. So if an individual is particularly weak, God will know that and means test that with extenuating circumstances. The effort, remember, at the end of the day, it's all will you do what you know to be right or not?
Mm.
Different people, everyone's no two people. Mm. Really, everyone you take, someone's weak and someone's stronger. So everyone's got a weak mind compared to someone else.
Yeah.
So whoever weak you are, as long as you're presentable with a choice, which means male, age of 13, female from the age of 12, and compass mentis, you're good to go for a challenge. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay, let us continue. Where do we get to? Hold on. Ah, 12. The true perfection destined for those worthy of it, however, is not attained either by body or soul alone, Dovi. It can't be, because it'll be an imperfect giving, but by the complete human being, by the complete man, consisting of both, combined body and soul, after the resurrection, in Olam Haba. It's got to make sense. Otherwise, how can he do it? If he gave just for the body or just the soul, it's an imperfect giving. He can't give an imperfect giving. If he did, he wouldn't be able to abide by it. Which is why he can't give my yacht in St. Moritz and say, that's going to be Olam Haba. He could give me my yacht in St. Moritz and say that's your Olam Haba, and that'd be a terrible punishment. That would be a terrible punishment. We'll talk about that in section 2. There is a way that people could get rewarded with their Olam Haba package in this world. Still have to pay harbour fees and port fees and careening fees and pay the everything. And that's their reward in Olam Haba. And we'll talk about how that is terrible because they have now lost out on infinity and gained temporal physicality as their infinity. And that's it. And God clears the debt with them. We'll talk about that.
Sorry, isn't any reward that God could give to the body by definition imperfect?
What a good question.
If it's been given to the body is imperfect. It can only appreciate imperfect things. It can only be around. It can't be around forever, which is imperfect.
I'm going to repeat the question for the tape, just in case it doesn't come through the tape. Dovid asked another brilliant question. Of like, if God is actually going to give the body anything, anything the body gets is always going to be failed. So how's that a giving? The answer is you're absolutely right if you think about it in this world. In the next world, the body will be so cleaned, so perfect. It will be, remember that Adam's skin prior to the sin was Or with an Aleph. Aleph Vav Resh. After the sin, it became Or with an Ayin. Ayin Vav Resh, meaning leather. His body was literally transparent, which is why the fingernails remain at the tips of the fingers and toes. His body, his skin, was nail, which means it's transparent. You can see that behind it. Adam's body was transparent. You could see the organs and the soul resting inside of his skin. If he'd walk in today, he would not look like a human being. We'd think he's an alien. We couldn't be able to comprehend it. When the body gets back to that supernal state after the resurrection, it's a perfect fitting unit for the soul. You have to give it to the body as well. The body at the end of the day was the vehicle by which commandments, mitzvahs, were done. The tefillin could only get on the arm. So it has to be a component of physical repose, has to be part and parcel
of. Is that body going to be around forever then?
That body will be around forever. It becomes immortal again, which is the way it's meant to be originally, as it was prior to the sin, which genetically makes sense. The apoptosis, which is the genetic structure which is pre-programmed cell death, just gets removed. Because that had to get added in for a period of time for the best purpose for man. Then it'll get removed and go back to the primordial stages it was meant to be once things are fixed up. Point 12, are we at point 12? Yeah? Goodness, we can really take it. Let's go for it. Besides being a place for the soul to await resurrection, the soul world also provides another benefit for the soul and ultimately for the resurrected body as well. Because of Adam's sin, it was decreed that man could attain perfection only after death. Even though his deeds may be such to have made him worthy of perfection while he was still alive. There are four men mentioned in Gemara Bava Basra, Tractate Bava Basra, page 17a, at the end of that chapter. It says, four men died only because of the poison of the serpent, which is the Lashon Hara that he spoke, i.e., had we not have had that, they could live it. They're so sin-free, they could just go on forever. Who were these four men? Unbelievable question. Who were the four men that were so sin-free that they really could, really, if it wasn't for the system that was stopping them, that had just literally never have died? Who were these super sick four men?
Methuselah.
Methuselah. No, he wasn't one of those. Wasn't one of those individuals. He's the longest lived man in Tanakh. 969 years, but he was not so sin free that he literally didn't need to die except for the whole thing that unfortunately, what can we do? We have to die.
Father of Moshe, Amram.
You could say Moses.
Amram, father of Moses, is one of those four people. Not Moses himself. Not Moses himself, but Amram, good to go.
Yeshua.
Yeah, okay, I think he's seen this before.
Have I ever?
Yeah, hold on just a second. He's giving me the answers. The four men are Amram, the father of Moses, Benjamin, the son of Jacob, Kalev, and Yishai. Kalev and Yishai. Yishai was the father of David, King David. Those four men were on such a level, says the Gemara, that if it wasn't for the system that we're talking about, they would have made it. But unfortunately, everyone's got to go. Those are examples of what we're saying here. For without life in this world, man would never attain perfection at all. You need this world. You need to overcome negativity, since the only time allotted for earning perfection is in this world before death. We're the ultimate experience of our lives, you know? Because everything else in the entire universe, right now, doesn't have as much free will and ability apart from us. We really are, to a certain extent, pretty much in control of our lives, to a certain extent. The choices that we have are really ours. Before life, it wasn't like that. You were just a soul waiting to be put into a body. After death, you're just being processed. There's no choice that you're given. Where would you like to go? It just happens to you. After the resurrection, you're just getting the reward that you worked at now. Really, now is the ultimate time to exist. Because now you are really in control as much as you will ever be in your existence. What an amazing and empowering concept. Gosh, the responsibility is huge. As a result of this decree, the body must remain immersed in evil in this world and can never, ever, ever completely disassociate itself from it, which Adam, by the way, could do prior to the sin. He could have just avoided eating it. But we can't do that now. We're stuck. The soul, which is associated with the body, is therefore also darkened and dimmed because of this state of affairs. Makes sense? It's not good for the soul, it's not good for the body. He really mucked it up for us. Sorry, Adam, if you're listening, I'm really... what can I do? Keep coming back to you, I don't mean to say it. But that's we've got to know the situation we're in, right? Through the good deeds that one has done, the soul might have indeed earned itself perfection and excellence, but this simply cannot be expressed in this world. This world doesn't work as a fitting place for this to happen. The soul cannot shine with radiance appropriate to the excellence that it actually attains, but it remains concealed in the soul's essence until the time comes for it to be revealed in Olam Haba, in the next world where the environment is applicable for such an experience. The soul, however, bears no blame whatsoever for this. It's only the nature of the human body, the mammalian component, that prevents its full expression. The body, however, also suffers a terrible and great loss because of this, since during man's physical lifetime, it cannot now be appropriately purified by the soul, which is the entire point of a body. Because we're so mired in filth, there's only so much you can get out of the situation. And the truth is, it needs to get more out of the situation. But what can it do? Nevertheless, the soul also loses out. Because during man's physical lifetime, it is now imprisoned and cannot spread its radiance, which is its nature, by the way. It furthermore cannot perform its proper task, which is purification of the body. He said this so many times now, it's 3 or 4 times. He hardly repeats himself in the whole book. So it's got to be a theme which is recurring. Now, I've underlined the word if. If the soul were able to do this, what's this? Purify the body. It would also perfect itself. Because that's its job, right? It's a feedback cycle. If the soul perfects the body gets perfected by the soul, the soul gets, oh, that's great, I perfected the body, which is my job. In purifying the body, the soul would resemble its creator. How? In doing good and bestowing perfection on another, the physical body. The soul mimics the creator by giving of its good to another. Who's the other? The body! What a design! What a design! It's a mimicry of the system itself. The soul mimics God, the body mimics man. Isn't that incredible within itself?
Can you just clarify on that point? We've got the Garden of Eden, which is highly spiritual. We've got, as far as I can see, this one major distraction, the serpent. It's the main challenge for Adam. All he's got to do is overcome that, and he's getting towards perfection, and he's got the ball rolling.
It's on track.
Okay? But we have a much more difficult job.
That's what we say.
Because we are, as it keeps saying here, mired, or as you say, in the filth.
Mm.
We've got so many distractions,
yep,
and so mm-hmm. much good and bad decisions to make every minute of the day. It's a much harder job.
Yeah.
And Hashem put these challenges, so our job is to resist them. Presumably that is what's concealing Hashem, is not doing these, refusing the negative mitzvahs, and doing the positive mitzvahs cleanses the soul.
Excellent.
And you're adding, it's like, is this a point system? I mean, you said at the beginning, don't consider it a point system. I mean, a couple of lessons back.
You said
don't consider a point system.
I think you, to a certain extent, if I did say that, I take it back. It is to a certain extent a point system. Because what you do, if you dwell in a sukkah on sukkahs,
yeah,
if you don't eat a forbidden mixture of foods at that particular time, then you do earn a particular level of closeness which will get paid in Olam Haba. We don't know what the waiting system is. We don't know which mitzvah earns us greater closer to the Creator and which aveira pushes us away from it. If we did, we'd all be going for gold. Rabbi Light, you forget to fill in because that's not really the rig. The big one is Shiluach HaKan, shooing away the mother bird. Let's plant some mother birds in the street.
Para Aduma.
We don't know. The truth is we don't know which one is gold. The truth why we don't know why which one is gold is because the truth is for each individual needs to do a different thing in this world. And the only thing you really need to do is do one thing once totally properly already to hook into this. So for look, let me explain to you something. Are you a Kohen or a Levi?
Kohen.
You're a Kohen? Okay, I'm a Yisrael, a plebeian.
Hey,
plebs. Up, plebs, good plebs. You've got mitzvahs that I can never fulfill. I have mitzvahs you can never fulfill. Levim have mitzvahs neither of us can fulfill. Women have mitzvahs we can never fulfill. Children have certain acts that we have to do to them, which we have to do chinuch, we have to train them. Can't do that. Everyone does their bit, and together we fulfill all 613. But no one person can do it all, because I'm not a Kohen, Levi, Yisrael, man, woman, child, boy, firstborn, living in a walled city. Everyone's got their station in life. What they have to do is what they have to do. So the pointing system is a fixed pointing system that is correct for each particular mitzvah. Plus it's then means tested for each individual at their pointing time and that generation and in that particular test.
Because there's environment and background.
Environmental, horoscopic and genetic factors are things we'll talk about in section 2 if we get there. Environmental, genetic and horoscopic factors are called hashkocha klolis, general providence, to which everyone, every human, Jew and Gentile, man and woman, are absolutely 100% affected by, as are animals. That's environmental, horoscopic, and genetic factors predicate certain things. We'll talk about another system of providence, which also kicks in for humans, but not for anything else, later in section 2, if we are meritorious to get to that point. Let's continue. Where did I get to? Oh! It must be now that, the soul was furthermore created, is that correct? Is anyone following? I've highlighted bits. If you can underline, I'm going to skip some words. Word says, can you see the soul was, underline that, skip the word furthermore, underline created for thee, skip the word very, underline purpose of purifying the body. So you could read it, the soul was created for the purpose of purifying the body. That's the fourth time he said it. And he doesn't mince his words, as we've learnt. He literally doesn't repeat anything. The soul was furthermore created for the very purpose of purifying the body, as we have discussed now at length. And therefore, in doing so, it will be fulfilling its purpose. This, in turn, would further enhance the soul, since everything is perfected by doing what was ordained for it by God. If you do what God wants, things get better. That's the concept of good. Remember the heat ray and the cold ray. When I was a kid, you know, the hot and the cold tub. Bad is an absence of good. Good is being more in line with with the directive. On the other hand, underline, every entity loses perfection as long as it's not fulfilling its purpose. Every entity, I've met people from all over the world. I've been zocher to teach people from so many different backgrounds. There are people I meet that do things that are very bizarre. They go bungee jumping. They go scuba diving, and I ask them why, and they say they're looking for something. Let me tell you, you can't fulfill yourself unless you actually fulfill your purpose. And you will not find it in local approximations of that. Either you're doing what you need to do, or you aren't. And all the time that you aren't doing it, you'll never really feel fulfilled. It's just part of the system. Every entity loses perfection as long as it's not fulfilling its purpose. And therefore, the soul loses a great deal of its power during man's physical lifetime. It can't help but lose it because of the situation that we're in, as described earlier. Now, when the soul leaves the body and enters the soul world, again, Olam HaNeshamos, not Olam HaBa, which doesn't exist yet, it can then radiate freely with the brightness that befits it as a result of its good deeds while it was associated with the body. Because what is a good deed if not a part physical component of it? Name me one mitzvah which doesn't need something physical. You can't do mitzvahs without a body. An astronaut can't do any task without a spacesuit. He can't be in that environment. Every mitzvah has a physical component. Every, now that is a hallmark that the whole system is true. Fancy coming up with a system that every single thing, there's always got to be something physical. Sorry? You need a brain for that. It's a spirit. It's one of the most spiritual. Avoid Azora is one of the most spiritual sins. But you're doing that because of lust in your body that you want to serve yourself. It's all done. That's ego. Let's get back to Adam's sin. Ahavazet, sorry, Rabbi Guntag asked, what about Ahavazet? What about love of God for the tape? What love of God? When you love things, the truth is that part of the things that humans love have physical components. Remember, all human needs, and sorry, all human wants, very good, like, come from needs. God's wants don't come from needs. Okay, that was the thing that we learned. That's, we've got to go over that and over there again. Okay, nail it. Okay, let's carry on. Can I carry on? Oh, through both this and what it can attain in the soul world, the soul is able to regain the power that it lost while it was associated with the body in this now sullied world, I would add. It wouldn't have had to do that had Adam not have sinned. This in turn makes it more qualified for its ultimate function after the resurrection, which is what, people? Without even reading ahead? What's the function of the soul? One more time, what's the function of the soul? Oh, let's read it inside, ultimate function. Come on, people, you can do it. What's this ultimate function of the resurrection? Namely, the purification of the body. It's the fifth time he's mentioned it. One thing you get from this course is the soul's job is to purify the body. The body's job is only to be purified by the soul. 13. We're going to do it. Even before a soul enters a body and attains perfection through its deeds, it can only attain perfection through its deeds while associated with a physical body, people. Because what is a deed if not a physical thing? It already has a very high degree of intrinsic perfection. The neshama is a very lofty creation. It's been made by God to do something very important. This intrinsic perfection and brilliance is so great that really technically it should be able to purify man's physical being immediately, I would add, without doing anything, to such an extent that he would no longer be considered mortal. When you put something as big as this huge angel inside a mammalian primate ape body, it should change that gorilla into such a lofty creature that this creature is now unbelievably supernal. The soul, however, is held back by God's decree. Comes back to the angels, the group of angels that came up to God and saying, we don't think this is a good idea. God's going to do it his way. Its power, the soul's power, is obstructed by a gezeira, by a writ from the creator, and its brilliance is reduced and turned down so that it can no longer do everything in its power to accomplish this. What is this that it must accomplish? Purification of the body. Like, we're getting somewhere, people. This soul thus remains imprisoned, as I explained, a tiger in a cage, and restrained to the degree required by God's plan so that it can be overcome by the body, if necessary, in order to do an Avera. Otherwise, it can never be overcome, right? If the soul was completely unfurled and super-duper, then how could a pork sandwich ever get in the way of that? We said last time that God's will is no more important in this world than a pork sandwich. Because if it was, then a pork sandwich wouldn't be a test. Pork sandwiches have to have the same potency as thou shalt not kill. Because otherwise, it's not an avera. The only way to change it is by you making it important. And it can only act upon the body to the extent that God's wisdom allows, i.e. making it fair and even. As the soul continues to participate in good deeds, it should likewise be able to spread out and radiate, thus purifying the body. The same decree, however, holds it back and prevents it from functioning freely until it reaches the soul world, which is Olam HaNeshamos, the holding zone, in between this world and the next. When the soul is recombined at Techiyas HaMesim, resurrection of the dead, with the body after the resurrection, however, it'll no longer be bound and restricted because it's fixed up. The body's fixed up. It's fixed up. It's like Adam didn't sin. And will enter the body with all of its brilliance and all of its strength. Underline, The body will then experience great enlightenment and will not have to develop gradually as a child now does. People will be born at full mature age, just like Cain and Abel were not born as children. They were born as adults in their 20s because they were conceived in a state where Adam existed prior to the sin. This does not mean, however, that the resurrected man will not be able to continue to elevate himself. When you get to Olam Haba, it's still a conveyor belt. You go up, you get closer and closer. The instant that the soul re-enters the body, the individual is raised to a very high, I would add, spiritual level. Why? Because the soul's been recharged and the body's been purified through the rotting process. And the body experiences its initial enlightenment it had prior to the sin in Eden. At this point, the body will immediately be on a higher level than it could ever have possibly attained in its first life in Olam Hazeh, this world. Because the decree of what we talked about being in the Maya, as Ronnie said, the Maya and the filth of this world, prevents that from happening. The degree of enlightenment, however, will depend, as we talked about Uncle Wolfie, on the individual's good deeds in his first life in Olam Hazeh. Makes sense, right? Everything's got to be making sense. And accordingly, he'll be placed on an appropriate level among those worthy of enjoying this ultimate perfection. This level, however, where they get into the actual party, is not a permanent level. The complete man, both body and soul, Dovi, you have to have the body, otherwise it's not fair, which will still be able now, from this starting point, to elevate himself in relation to the initial level upon which he's placed. So what's the difference between this world and the next world? Let me tell you. Two people. Okay, person one, person two. Person one here was born into a very righteous family in Jerusalem. Very righteous family in Jerusalem. Grew up doing all the mitzvahs and avoiding all the avirus. Person two, sheet of paper, was born into an extremely non-righteous family in Crawley. You don't like it? This is my analogy, okay? I can pick what I want. You don't like Crawley? Yeah, for fun. Crawley's a town. Crawley, not a righteous family. Now, the person, number one, who was born in Mea Shearim and who is an incredibly righteous person, can unfortunately completely ruin himself and end up doing every single avera in the book. And the person from Crawley can elevate himself and end up, when they die after 120, that this individual is on a higher than that individual. That can happen in this world, right? In the next world, things are different. There's no overtaking or undertaking. When you get in at that point, and you both grow at the same rate continually. There's no overtaking or undertaking. It would be unfair to overtake or undertake. You get in at that point because of all the effort that you yourself have put in based upon everything you've done while in a physical body. And that body then basks in the glory, as it were, of the closeness of the Creator and keeps going. But there's none of this business. You only get this business. I'm moving the items up and down, showing a change in level. I've got to do this because some people aren't here. They want to hear the what can I do, guys? So this concept of moving up and down can only exist in a world where errors can be made. No error can be made in Olam Haba. Because Olam Haba isn't a place of error because there's no evil. There's no evil because evil can't be allowed to exist, because if it did, it would kambosh God's plan of giving his good to another. Because evil would be the Hitlers moving in next door. Remember? That was the analogy. You get your mansion and who's... Oh, good enough. So what? Adolf Hitler was moving in next door? God, I just can't have that. We have to write to the council. You can't have that in Olam Haba. Wicked people have to be removed. You can't have that. Because if that existed, it would ruin your repose there. There can't be an error there. Which means the choice is only air. Can't be anywhere else. There is no choice in Olam Haba. You have no opportunity for choice. There are no mitzvahs, there are no averas, because there's no good or bad. It's just God giving of his good to another, which is the prime protocol of creation, which none of us can escape. I'm not telling you what to believe. I'm only telling you what Jewish philosophy states. I keep saying that. You want to walk out from here and believe in anything you want, bavakasha, I'm not telling you what to believe. Just that you know clearly what the classical Torah sources explain as the purpose and meaning of creation. With that, we've completed the chapter of man. people, I want to tell you something, and I'm going to close with it. Let's say, in the first session that we had with the Blue Orange, some of you were here for, that you heard something that was really, really, really deep, really amazing, really enlightening, really good, let's say. Let's just pretend that. Then let's pretend in the second session, it was a lady, it was a lady Karen, right? There's one thing you say every session I like, and the rest of it, do you remember that? There's one thing you say every time that I actually quite like. Let's say that, Karen, if you're listening, think of the things that you liked in each session. Now, I've got news for you. This goes on aggregate. We're playing for the long game here. You come to one session, that was quite good. Yeah, said something that was really rather interesting. I can't really fault that. Good within its own logic and axiom. Go another session, that's another thing. Go another session, it's another thing. These things keep happening. You can't just take them as individual scores. You have to start looking at what's going on big picture here. We've discussed in only 5 sessions, because the first session was only an intro. In 5 sessions, we have knocked out the abstract concept of the creator, according to Jewish concepts. This creator's entire purpose in what he is doing, how he's doing it through the function of creation, how man plays its part in that, and how every single concept of man must exist, how the soul and the body, life and death all are. Remember my barber? What's it all about? What's it all about? Well, Mr. Barber, it's about an infinite, perfect, uncreated being fulfilling his prime protocol of giving his good to another in a world where opportunity exists to either flagrate or attach yourself to his directives and therefore earn rights justifiably of closeness to that being. Now, you don't have to say it like that, but you've got everything I've just said is 5 double sessions condensed into one sentence. The truth is, this stuff is simple. It has to be, because the creator is simple. He has no component parts. So everything about him must be simple. It's us that makes things complex. Because we're complicated, we have subsystems. If he's so simple and so one, then his will of everything is really one. It's us that can't really get that. He lives outside the realm of time. He doesn't know what's going to happen tomorrow, and he's unaware of what happened yesterday, because there are no tomorrows or yesterday. There's just now. That's the most simple way of being. Time makes things complicated. There's no history and no future. This whole thing is a blue orange. It just is. It's the orange that experiences these limitations, so it can make individual choices. All this should be now starting to become obvious within its own axiom. It's got to be so sitting, so well, so clearly, so simply, that its simplicity and its beauty is part of its truth. It's the first time I've sold it to you. It's part of its truth. Because something so simple, where we would think it's so impossibly, how can you even discuss it? That's actually the signet that something's going on here. It's been my honour, and I really mean that, to be able to address you about these topics. And as my pet peeve was, you were robbed. You should have had this in nursery. You should have had it in primary school. You should have had it in secondary school. Yeshiva and seminary. But they didn't tell it to you because they didn't know it themselves, because no one transmitted it to them. And when that kid that I met that I told you about said, when he asked, can God do this? And he got punched by his Rebbe, that should never happen. Because these questions are good questions. They're real questions. They're the foundational questions. They're the big things to get clear. But frankly, once you've got them clear, they're very simple. They're very, very simple. There's hardly anything to discuss. It's simple. I just summed it up in a sentence. I'm glad, I'm honoured that you'd be able to stick it out. But 6 of these sessions that you've been able to sit through, my like insane analogies and things like that, like Uncle Wolfie and the yacht and the blue orange and everything. Like, well done to all of you. Well done to all of you. It's not been easy, but you made it. You made it. And I've got to say, I'm really impressed. Because this stuff isn't easy to grapple with when your mind's never been open to it before. But once you got it, it's simple. It's actually simple. I would like to take this opportunity to thank Dovi Coleman, everyone at the Whitefield Forum. I couldn't thank every member of the Whitefield community, especially Daniel Gordon, Paul Dardick, for inspiring to tell him, please, will you do this at all? And I did it. I hope that you've got something beneficial and or illuminating out of it, that at least you have a clearer idea of what the classical Torah sources actually say, what is actually going on. If, now we've finished those three chapters, which are the biggest, most complicated three chapters that there are in the book, if you want to continue, I'm happy to continue. If you want to stop there and say, you know what, then it's still been worth it. Still been worth it. I'd like to thank you for your dedication of turning up. I'd like to thank you all for being here. Thank you so, so much for giving me the opportunity to go through this material with you. And I hope, please God, that you'll be able to use this material in your daily lives to get more clarity, more fulfillment, more understanding, and more happiness in every single activity that you ever do. Because this stuff permeates everything from what you're going to have to lunch, to what you do as a living, to how you interface with other people. It makes things so much more real. Thank you so, so much. And please God, I hope to see you again soon. Yeah. Thank you very much.